My name is Norma Field. I am retired from the University of Chicago. I have been going to Fukushima since November of 2011, so about 8 months after the disaster struck. My principal contact is a woman activist, Ruiko Muto, R-U-I-K-O. And then her surname, family name, Muto, M as in Mary, U-T-O. And what is distinctive about her work, she was a longtime anti-nuclear activist before this happened. She was put out of business by it. There are about 30-some lawsuits, I think, many, many plaintiffs. What she has done, however, because watching what was going on, no one was being held responsible for the disaster. And she felt that was, she and others felt that that was, it was not a good thing for no one to be held responsible. So she mobilized citizens of Fukushima and then first, or anyone who had lived there at the time, including foreigners, and then after that, people from around the country to become what are called complainants. We have complaints in the U.S. legal system, too. This is somewhat different in Japan because she noticed that the prosecutors, neither prosecutors nor police, were bringing charges against TEPCO or anyone in the government. So no one was being held, as I said, liable for this. So she mobilized a complaint and a complainants association to urge the district prosecutors to bring charges against a number of officials and in TEPCO and in government. And this went through several rounds. The prosecutors investigated, said, there's no evidence that there's anything indictable here. Then they tried again. And then it went to an interesting system, something like a grand jury. And then eight of those citizens chosen at random held that three officials of TEPCO, no one in the government, three officials of TEPCO were indeed liable and that this should be pursued. At which point, they went back again to the Fukushima prosecutors who said once again, no, we don't think anyone is should be liable. Once more to a citizens' committee. And this time, once again, eight of the 11 said, right, these three officials. And so this very unusual criminal trial has started in Japan. It was clear that the prosecutors, who are the people who should be doing the indictment and prosecuting this case, had no willingness to do so. So the court appointed five attorneys. So five attorneys who have law practices and whatnot to serve in the capacity as of prosecutors. So one session of this has been held, and who knows how long it will go on. But these are the people I'm closest to. Of course, I learn a great deal else about health effects, the thyroid cancer issue, what's going on in schools, and all the anecdotal things you hear about only by going there, which is how many people are talking about sudden deaths of young people in their circles, so that one person might say, just last year, of people I know directly or that a close friend or relative knows, you know, four people died suddenly, even beginning with a middle schooler. So there's a great deal happening that we don't hear or read about.
A sudden death, not suicide.
Not suicide, although I think there is plenty of that. In fact, I have seen a report on the public broadcaster where a researcher from Fukushima Medical University was saying that in the three prefectures affected by the triple disaster, by the tsunami and the earthquake in Fukushima, the others were affected too by the radiation, but only in Fukushima, 4 and 5 years after the disaster, can we see that the suicide rate is going up, whereas in the two main other areas that were affected, that are mainly affected by the earthquake and tsunami, the suicide rate is declining. But what I'm talking about, sudden death, is not suicide.
Sudden death.
Mm-hmm.
Your work as an academic has been in looking at the cultural
and historical, and social, yes.
Can you talk about how this disaster, in that context, about the relationships that may have changed, about people's perception of themselves, about the changing culture, about whether writers are coming forward with cultural work about the disaster, or if it's being encouraged or suppressed.
Yeah, I mean, I will say, first of all, I'm finding that truth is stranger than fiction right now. So I have myself have not delved. There is a whole literature that's emerged from Fukushima. I myself have focused much more on documentary films. And I believe there are more documentary films than fiction films that have come out of Fukushima. My hypothesis is just my gut instinct is people making the documentary films are committed. And they go through the hardships of raising the money, and there's a whole system of distributing, screening documentary films through, from activist circle to activist circle, where the people all around Japan will gather in their locale, raise the money to screen the film. Feature films are going to be relying much more on commercial money, and I have a feeling that's one reason. The two that I know of have gotten a lot of fiction films, gotten their capital from abroad, like the U.S. or Germany. So, but let me talk about changes. When Fukushima happened and the demonstrations appeared, people started, and there was a myth, like the safety myth of nuclear power, the Japanese people don't demonstrate. Well, that's absolutely false. The world and Japanese themselves had forgotten that they are a demonstrating people. And there are many, many protests after World War II. And any attempt for Japan to remilitarize, right, it doesn't have an army. It does de facto, but it's not called that. It's called a self-defense force. Any attempt to militarize is met with stiff opposition. So this kind of huge mobilization in surrounding the parliament, etc., took place through the 1960s and hasn't. We talked about money a little bit at the end of the session. I think Japanese people were bought off by prosperity. You know, the opposition to this, to remilitarization and what that meant for Japanese society was bought off by income. It was called an income doubling plan. So it's not that Japanese people don't demonstrate. It's that there was a long lull. And certainly before the war, which is another part I've worked on, very robust opposition movements.
Opposition before the war and during the war?
During the war was very hard because there was anticipatory confinement. You arrest people, you detain people likely to cause trouble.
Like in the United States.
Yes. Yes.
Likely to be terrorists.
Yeah, likely to be terrorists because they question what's called the peace and security law, commonly in English translation, but it's the public order law. There were two things you were not supposed to criticize, the emperor system and this private property. So if anything that you said that smacked of your being a leftist or a liberal, it just got more and more confining. First it was people suspected of being members of the illegal Communist Party. Then it was, people suspected of maybe being a delivery boy to something who was just happened to be ensnared, caged. So it expanded to include all kinds, anyone.
McCarthyism.
Well, exactly. So during the war it was hard. It's not that there was no protest at all or no opposition or no resistance, but certainly up.
Was it a fascist regime? Would you characterize that?
Emperor state fascism is a term some people use. I can't answer that. It was, there was certainly no freedom of thought or expression.
So it's a lot more similar to the United States than people really...
Oh, very similar. And if I don't know if you remember the 1995 hullabaloo about the Smithsonian exhibit,
the
50th anniversary. The attempt of the curator of the Smithsonian to give modest hints of what happened under the mushroom cloud, warped metal lunch boxes... Up until then, all that Americans were asked to imagine was that mushroom cloud, not what happened on the ground to human beings, to human flesh, horse's flesh, whatever. That attempt to introduce a glimpse of what was under the mushroom cloud ended up in his getting fired. But at the time,
congressional censure, a huge outpouring of negative reporting from the mainstream media, and it was the Air Force Association that led it. Do you know who constitutes the Air Force Association?
No, to tell.
It's the major industrial corporations that manufacture the weapons of war.
Well, very good. That makes complete sense. And I remember then that U.S. veterans were brought up, you know, to the front to express, I think, a lot driven by politicians. I mean, the veterans might not have known about a Smithsonian exhibit, right? The veterans said, oh, we can't disgrace what we did, and calling it into question. Well, on the other side of the Pacific, there are Japanese veterans who are always complaining about any kind of sacrilegious speech or acts to the sacred spirits of our comrades, right? And I thought, you know what really needs to happen? Bring these two groups of vets together in one room because they're saying the same things.
Actually, there was a woman who made a film who brought American Navy vets who had been on ships that kamikazes had attacked, and surviving kamikaze pilots. There are survivors.
Yes.
And it was quite an interesting discussion and realization that they came to about the nature of the human beings that they accepted themselves with.
Yes, I know. And it's too bad that it's happening so late, because there are not too many surviving on. Also, another important conversation that took place was Japanese who became POWs of China after the People's Republic came in. And they were treated better than their captors, and they were asked to reflect on what they had done. They became great spokespeople for Japan-China friendship, excoriated by the government. Conservative Party for saying, you know, what, you're going to take the part of those communists, right? You want a friendship with those people? Well, yes, because we reflected on what we were doing and what the history was.
And the same with American POWs who spoke positively about the Korean.
Yes, exactly. They were brainwashed, right? Yeah.
And so you mentioned money, and in your talk you mentioned that at the program that this today's is a counter to, where yesterday the University of Chicago sort of beat the band to honor and see only in a positive light, a half-truth, this enormous risk to the city of Chicago's residents that they took when they gambled with running that experiment because they couldn't
do it in the Cook County Forest Preserve.
Well, because of a labor.
Yes, because of a labor action, because there was a strike at what now is Argonne National Laboratory. Yes, I know that. That never got discussed. It's what happened yesterday at the University of Chicago. Well, the nuclear power panel was most illustrative, having the CEO of Exelon. And this was on the nuclear energy panel, so he was only being asked to talk about the importance of nuclear power.
Right, but I thought they had a CEO who used to be a
naval
guy.
I just thought it was, well, I thought then, whom are you going to, because I'm always being asked about balance and what I organize. And the other person was the Milton Friedman professor of the Energy Policy Institute. And I think it's, and therefore there was no sustained back and forth. And I would expect at the University of Chicago that there would be some serious discussion, or else afterwards there's a discussant who can clarify for the general public what was said and what was not said. It was as if the university were determined to speak for the nuclear industry, the nuclear weapons industry, and the energy industry, and how this was set up. And I think that is beneath the dignity of the institution where I worked.
I admit to a bias against the institution at which you worked, which does many fine things, but it was also founded by somebody whose primary interest was expanding the power of capital, and industrialism and the form of fascism that passes as democracy in the United States.
Yeah. You know, I'm sorry.
And that it, just like it refuses to bring its assets, of which there are many, many brilliant people and minds and resources at the university to address the contamination problem or even the philosophical issues that are embedded in mutually assured discussion.
Mm-hmm. Destruction.
It fails to criticize neoliberalism and its key proponents, Friedman, and the way they've used the Nobel Prize to validate their very unscientific, destructive, pro-capitalist, pro-selfishness worldview.
Yeah. The thing, though, that we have to remember is that when you, for example, many people were criticized, have been very critical of the money that went into the Defense Department, or the Defense Department money that supported the study of critical foreign languages. The funny thing about money is that it can be laundered, as you well know, and can be used for many things.
You can't always control what you do.
That is the saving thing. So, but the University of Chicago has produced and continues to produce many critical scholars. Now,
like that fellow Bo, did he come out of there?
No.
Oh, okay.
But University of Illinois, yeah. There are many, many fine scholars. I think. Then there's the other caveat, is that we do have to have a society that has a robust enough belief in the freedom of the academy that critical scholarship can continue to be produced. And that's a big if, where we are right now. And again, the matter of funding. How can critical scholars continue to get the support they need to do their scholarship?
Would that say... effect of the neoliberal, my assessment, Friedman-esque value system that chooses to defund critical voices or overwhelm them.
Well, it can also be more subtle. It's what kind of scholarship is fashionable, right? And that can also have a very dampening effect. So I'm worried on both ends. Something somewhat to very crude on the level of drawing up funds, and something the more subtle one about making certain kinds of scholarship unfashionable.
If you talk to economists who are alternative in their analysis, eco-socialists in their analysis, they say that their papers would stand up to any peer-reviewed journal. They just can't get them into the peer-reviewed journal because they're dominated by people who are connected to the Friedman-esque.
And they don't want to put their funding and jobs at risk. So, and that will reproduce itself on and on and on, because remember, these are teachers as well as researchers.
Right. And the corporations continue to embed themselves like a virus into the social structure and the mental structure.
Well, that's what I saw yesterday. That was really, you know, a part of me was dismayed at the information being purveyed, but also the corporate model that was on demonstration as to what the identity of the University of Chicago is to be on this occasion of this key symposium, you know, the hardcore stuff, not the art, the arts today, but that was very dismaying to me, because you don't want to take down an institution in that way. You don't want to be doing it with your own hands.
That's the power of money. Anyway, thank you very much, Norma Field.
Yeah, pleasure, Dale.
I really appreciated what I've learned from your presentations at earlier conferences. I hope you'll continue to participate in them.
I hope I can, too. Thank you so much for your interest. It's very heartening.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.